Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, if you're wondering what it looks like when Scotty Scheffler puts it all together, wonder no more. The world number one set a bogey-free 66 in the final round at Bay Hill, won the Arnold Palmer Invitational by five shots, his first win in 51 weeks. That obviously sets him up nicely, not just for his title defense next week at the Players Championship, but the rest of the major season with the Masters now just 1 month away. Rex, you were there. You are still there, sipping a Yingling, no doubt. What did it look like? What did it sound like? What did it feel like as Scotty rolls to his seventh PGA Tour victory?
I just realized I made a huge tactical error setting up. So the actual media center is just in the next room over. And as we've done this before, you don't want to bother the other guys who are on deadline. So I came into the lunchroom, and apparently there's pizza and beer behind me. So it's going to be a high traffic area. I just realized this is the one place that I probably shouldn't have set up. It was fun. It was fun to watch him, as you said, put it all together. It was fun to kind of write the story, because he sort of hinted on it earlier in the week, just about the idea that I'm going to figure this out because I've decided I'm not going to be perfect. I'm not even going to try to be perfect. And he kind of expanded on that a little bit tonight when I asked him about it. And along the way, along these 12 months, and it is interesting that you just said his first victory since the Players' Championship. He won the Hero. And granted, it's a small field. It's in the Bahamas.
First official victory, I should say.
It is his first official victory. So I do think you need to say that. But this is, you're right, what it looks. I thought Shane Lowry, who he played with today at Bay Hill, said it best. He goes, he showed us why he's world number one. Rory McIlroy just marveled. He goes, when we all know how good of a ball striker he is. We all know what he can do if you put a golf club in his hand. All I needed to do was figure it out and just putt average. Like, I think we've had this conversation before. It's not like he needed to go out there and be Brad Faxon. He didn't need to go out there and be the world's best putter, just putt average. And today, he was much, much better than average, and he wins by five. So I think he gained 4.5 strokes on the field and won by five. I don't think those numbers are mutually exclusive.
I agree with you. And we now have a large enough sample size that when Scotty Scheffler putts great, not when he putts average, when he putts great, there is no beating him. And in fact, he's probably going to win in a rout as he did on Sunday. This is the fourth time since the beginning of 2022 that Scotty Scheffler for the week has gained more than four shots on the field on the greens. His results in those four events, Rex, win, 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 win. I mean, the guy is absolutely lights out. I did think this was kind of surprising just because of what we'd seen from him so far this season. And by all accounts, it has been a pretty solid season. His worst finish was a T17, still had a boatload of top 10 finishes in the early returns here. But his last tournament was at the Genesis Invitational, where once again, he was first in the field in strokes gained tee degree and last in the field in putting. You talked to him throughout the course of the week. What's the turnaround? Is this just kind of a one-week aberration, or is the strides that he's been making with Phil Kenyon once they started working together after the Tour Championship last fall kind of starting to pay dividends?
I think it's a combination of a couple of different things. I don't want to discredit the work he's doing with Phil Kenyon. I think it's been very, very good. I think the switch to a mallet-headed putter, he started with a new putter this week.
Thank you, Rory.
Thank you, Rory. Actually, he was asked about that, and he sort of laughed it off. And he pointed out that they had been talking about it internally, Randy Smith, Phil Kenyon, for a long time before Rory brought it up. But it was
testing. He was testing him last summer. But it was, you're right. Like, that was what Rory said last in 2 weeks ago. Last start at the Genesis. But yeah. Man. Thankfully, Scotty's not using a mallet because he actually gives us a chance. Once he puts them out of the bag, wins by five, it blows away Rory. He beat him by 10 shots.
Yes.
Had a chance to win on Sunday, which was very interesting.
So I think those two things certainly factor into this. This has been a long process. We have talked about this for pretty much a year now, right? I mean, we know how good of a ball striker he is, and the putting just hasn't been there. And it's not as though it hasn't been great. It's been bad. Like, I went through all of those events since last year, since the Players' Championship, since that victory. And, I mean, he's just not losing 0.5 strokes. He's losing 4.5 strokes. He's losing 7 strokes in one tournament. Like, it was bad, bad putting. And so I think this is an indication more, though, than anything he's doing physically, than anything he's doing equipment-wise. I think it was just a mental adjustment that we know Scotty. Like, he's a thoughtful guy. And I think he finally wrapped his mind around the idea that he can't get caught up in the outcome. And this is going to sound like the cliche that the sports cliches always are, but he needed to let go of the outcome. And he did that Thursday. And I think that was a key for him. He said he went out and shot 70, felt like he left so many shots out there. But then he and Teddy were standing on the range after the round, and they looked at each other and they're like, man, I felt like he actually putted pretty well. And I think that's the key when it comes to putting. If you're just not, if you're not one of those Brad Faxons, if you weren't born touched by the hand of God to be able to just hit the putts, if you're not Jordan Spieth, if you don't have that gene, I think you need to wrap your mind around the idea that if I hit a good putt, if I hit the line I was trying to hit and it had the speed that I wanted to and it just doesn't go in, there's nothing I can do about it. I just need to move on to the next hole. For the perfectionist that is the PGA Tour player, that's really, really hard to do. And I just think he did a better job of that this week.
Yeah, so here's a little bit, Rex, of a peek behind the curtain. I sat down with Scottie Scheffler for about 20 minutes on Saturday after his third round at Riviera, trying to do some reporting for a Scottie Scheffler Players' Championship preview piece. The premise of the story was not going to be, as you have surmised, an obit to Scottie Scheffler or burying him for what has been his misfortune and misgivings on the green. In fact, it was more glowing than that. It was basically his reflections on the past year, what at this time was a 51-week winless drought and kind of the bugaboo. There was a couple premises to the piece that unfortunately will probably now never see the light of day on NBCSports.com/golf. One is that there has not been much in Scottie's athletic career that has ever befuddled him. From junior golf to other sports to college, he has always figured out stuff, which is why the putting predicament that he's found himself in has been so maddening to him. As you say, kind of this pursuit of perfection. Well, throughout the history of Scottie Scheffler's golfing life, it's been pretty close to perfection. This is a player who won almost 75% of his junior starts over a decade span. He was a former U.S. junior champion. He was a three-time high school state champion. In college, he nearly won an NCAA championship. He was picked for the Walker Cup team. He won a couple of times. He got through sort of the injuries and the issues that he had with his back in college. Like, he has always, always, always come out the other side. And so that's why this has been such a test mentally for him, to have the right perspective, to have the right patience, the right levels of patience, because quite frankly, this was something that he was unaccustomed to. The thing with Scottie that I found most interesting is that he really doesn't understand he definitely acknowledges that the fact that as world number one, he has to get nitpicked. You know, he's under a microscope. What he doesn't like and what he kind of framed differently is if you watch, he said during the fall when he had some downtime, he watched some of Tiger's old clips when Tiger was winning golf tournaments. And he said people were ripping Tiger's ass, his words, not mine, ripping Tiger's ass. Whoa. On the coverage if he ever missed a 15-foot putt, because you just sort of you just assumed he was going to make it. You just assumed that a player of his prodigious talent was going to make that putt. And Scottie says, I've kind of entered that territory with golf commentators. If they show me, lining up a 15-foot putt, And they preface it by saying, you know, this is the area of the game that Scottie Scheffler really struggles with, and then he misses it. It's sort of self-perpetuating, and so that's kind of what he's been dogged by over these past 52 weeks, and probably a little bit longer as well. The fact that he's being nitpicked and asked constantly about the thing that he does worst in golf. No one's asking about his ball striking. No one's asking about the fact that he is on par basically with Tiger's peak seasons in terms of his long game. It's always constantly the one thing you don't do well. And that can really affect a player mentally. I mean, we wouldn't want to hear that constantly every single day of life. No. I mean, you're a great reporter, Rex, but your writing, you're kind of sucks. But Lavender, you can really write, but on TV, you're dreadful. Both of those two things can be true, but to hear them over and over again, it's certainly kind of where the feelings got rubbed a little bit raw for Scottie Scheffler.
And I can see that frustration. And I think we have seen bits and pieces of that over the year. And look, I think there's something to be said for there is an ebb and flow to his seasons that are pretty easy to track, right? He always seems to play pretty well at the Waste Management. He always seems to play pretty well here, where he's won twice now at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Seems to play pretty well at the Players' Championship, where, as you pointed out, he's a defending champion. It's those West Coast venues that have Poa greens, which, look, they're confusing. It's not Scottie Scheffler's problem. This is a golf problem. It's really, really hard to putt on those greens. And then as we get further north, I'm not talking about Augusta. I'm talking about the venues where you're dealing exclusively with bent greens, and it's a little bit different than what he grew up putting. I think it's a comfort level. Like, I feel like he's pretty comfortable on Bermuda greens. I feel like he's pretty comfortable on the bent greens that are out in Scottsdale, because those are pretty basic, pretty easy to deal with. And he certainly has something for Augusta. So I think there is an ebb and flow to this that explains at least part of it. But I went back just and looked at his, ever since he joined the PGA Tour, every year that he played a full schedule, just once has he ranked inside the top 100 in putting. I don't think he's ever been a great putter, and I don't think he's ever going to be a good putter. I think he still has a chance of being the world number one for a really, really long time, because he hits the ball that well.
It almost felt, Rex, like I was being trolled. I mean, Scottie Scheffler made each of his last 23 putts inside 15 feet. A couple weeks ago, that would have seemed unfathomable. A couple of months ago, that would have seemed inconceivable. Last summer, remember Muirfield Village? He gained like 23 shots on the field with his ball striking and lost like 9 on the greens. Like, we'd never seen that great of a disparity. You never would have seen Scottie Scheffler make 23 consecutive putts.
He was 15 for 15 today from 15 feet, from inside 15 feet. He made a 34-footer. Like, all the things he had to do today, he did. He looked like the guy that you would expect. Oh, yeah, that's the world number one, because he does everything really, really well. And I kind of used the perfect line, you know, trying to get away from being perfect, because you would look at today's round, at least statistically, from the outside looking in, and you can make an argument, man, that was a perfect round. No bogeys.
The worst part was his approach play.
Yeah. I mean, which is crazy. Amazing. I mean, the closest he probably came to a bogey was on 17, and everything was in the bag by then. He had a plug lie and just hit this beautiful shot to pretty much tap in range. So it looked like a perfect round from the outside. So I just love sort of the machinations of what's going on inside his head. He looks so calm on the outside, and he looks so put together and at peace with himself. But I think he gave a little bit of a glimpse. You said you hadn't read the transcript yet, but you probably should, because I think he did kind of open up a little bit on what the last year has been like. He's heard everything. He knows better than we do exactly where his shortcomings on. He said he focused on it in the offseason. Whether or not that's going to pay off long term, I think we still need to give it some time. But I think today was a big first step.
I didn't cover Tiger's prime in the early 2000s, or even that 05 to 07 period. I was just beginning my career when Rory was going on his assault in 2012 and 2014. But listening to Scottie's peers, it's very interesting to hear how they talk about Scottie's play, of how, like, wow, we all know he's at another level ball striking wise. And if he can just make some more putts, like, he's going to do some things that are very, very, very difficult for us to catch. Like, you can hear the level of respect for a man of his immense talent, and how I think everyone, certainly his peers, are kind of dreading that, or they're hoping that this was a 1 week aberration, or they're dreading the fact that, hey, maybe he's actually made some strides on the greens. You look at his stats this week. He was first tee to green. He was first around the green. I think that's one of the things that's kind of overlooked about Scottie Scheffler. He's a big man with very soft hands who can play a ton of really nifty, creative shots around the green. He certainly did that at Bay Hill. He was fifth in putting, but he was 12th in approach play. I don't have the stats in front of me. I have a hard time believing that this was not actually his worst iron performance in months, if not longer. Yeah. I mean, Scottie's never 12th. In the field. And so it was just an absolutely clinical performance. And I'm very curious to see how he follows it up this week at TPC Sawgrass.
And I can say, like, I mean, we all watched with great interest today, because Sunday was going to be the day that if there were any shortcomings on the greens, it was going to be glaring today. Like, that's the day we put the microscope down. And if you missed the 5-footer, then everyone's going to say, yep, there it is. We knew it was coming. I don't think there was a putt today that I saw him getting ready to hit that I was like, yep, he's not making this one. Like, I just felt like there was a confidence, there was an air about him. And it's not as though he had been putting great all week. He hadn't been giving strokes away, is essentially what he had been doing. Today just felt like everything came together.
One player for whom it did not, even though he did have a chance, was the world number two, the guy who's actually closest to overtaking Scottie Scheffler in the world rankings, however you still feel about the world rankings, but Rory actually needed a little bit of a rally on the back nine just to close with 76, just to finish in a tie for 21st. He hit only 40 of 72 greens, which was almost last in the field in approach play. When we did the preview podcast, Rex, on Wednesday, we kind of prefaced it by saying, hey, you know, we're willing to give Rory a little bit of grace here. He doesn't typically play well on the West Coast. He almost had the doubleheader in Dubai to start the year. But if he does not play well at Bay Hill, that's when you can kind of sound the alarms a little bit, which is two tournament starts remaining until, at least for him, the year's first major. Where are you now on the Rory stress-o-meter?
I found it interesting that he talked about his drive, and he was second in the field, strokes gained tee to green, just behind Scottie Scheffler. So he has a lot of confidence there, and he almost had a bit of a chip on his shoulder when he said, let me guess, I led the field again off the tee. Well, he didn't, but he was really, really close because he knows how well he's driving the ball. And normally when Rory's driving the ball, well, everything else flows. Like, everything else falls in behind his driver. I think it was more his iron play, and he seems to have a case of a lot of pulls with his irons. And he talked about the idea that he's got 3 days going into next week's Players Championship to figure it out. The good news is TPC Sawgrass is a really, really tough driving test, and he feels like he can pick up a lot of strokes there. It's not like it's all that easy on approaches, though, either. He's going to have to hit much better iron shots. I do think it was interesting. We talked a lot about Rory's putting as well. He actually putted pretty well this week. I mean, not as well as Scotty did, certainly on Sunday, but again, he is the guy when he is.
He was working really hard with Fax after the opening round, for sure.
I think whatever happened Thursday night between he and Fax, and Rory got into that a little bit, talking about how his right shoulder tends to ride up, and he ends up hitting putts almost thin, which I found fascinating because I hit every putt thin. I just thought that's the way you were supposed to do it. But watching, and I actually talked to Brad about it a little bit, about exactly what they're working on, and he has his tendencies. That's the interesting part. I mean, Rory is a very, very smart guy. I don't think I need – that's not news to anyone. He's very thoughtful. He spends a lot of time thinking about things in the world as well as his golf game. And it seems to me he keeps coming back to that one thing when it comes to his putting. But you very rarely see that, where a guy is putting in the dark at Bay Hill on Thursday night and comes out Friday morning firing and has a good round. Every time I see that, I'm thinking, yeah, that he's done. Like, you don't figure it out overnight. And he did that, which gives me a little bit of hope going into next week. But he's got to figure out his iron play. It's bad right now.
Yeah, and I think that's actually quite concerning as we look ahead to both TPC Sawgrass and Augusta National. Rory is ranked 133rd this season on tour in approach play. You mentioned the left miss. I think that reared its head over and over again this week on the sixth hole, the par five, where he's trying to hit kind of a long to mid iron. He played the par five hole and four over for the week, just could not help the left miss. We saw it doom him a couple times overseas as well. It's just a real bugaboo for him. And as we know, and as we've seen over the past decade, there is no greater indicator of success at Augusta National than iron play. The days of it being a putting contest are over. It's not just a driving contest anymore. He can be center of the fairway on every single hole, but if he cannot capitalize and hit it to the right shelf at Augusta National, he's really going to struggle. That has to be a major point of emphasis, not just next week and getting ready for the golf's fifth major, but Augusta National and the Masters as well.
I think it's so funny. You're also seeing the traffic behind me of all the, yeah, all, yeah. See them all?
The hooligans just sucking down their Yinglings and stuffing their faces with some greasy pizza. I did also, Rex, want to touch on something that created a little bit of stir as it relates to Rory, with his idea that the PGA Tour should be more cutthroat. And Wyndham Clark followed up again on Saturday saying he agrees with Rory's premise that the PGA Tour should essentially just be the best of the best, call it 100 guys, whatever the number is. It basically just make it not more of a closed shop, but make it kind of an aspirational circuit for the best of the best. This did not go over well at all on social media, saying, don't you remember where you came from? These are the stories that we want. We want more promotion. We want more relegation. Where did you fall on this, and were you surprised by some of the blowback that both of these players received as it pertains to what seems like a pretty logical idea?
Very surprised with Wyndham Clark, the blowback he got. I was actually talking with a tour official this afternoon. afternoon about it, because I think 100, and maybe that's not the right number. Someone mentioned, I was actually asked Lucas Glover about it after his round on Sunday, and he felt like 125 was probably a better number just because that's been the number historically. And his argument was that these fields should be 125. That's a different conversation. I actually think Wyndham had thought this through, and I understand where he was coming from. I think the blowback came from the idea that someone posted that he was outside the top 100, what, 18 months ago, right before he won the Wells Fargo? And I think the idea that the argument was, oh, well, you wouldn't be in that magical number. Well, that's not necessarily true. Like, Wyndham Clark is clearly a good player. We know that now. I mean, he was about to win his third signature event this week if Scottie Scheffler doesn't Scottie Scheffler. So we all know he's talented. I think eventually he would have played his way on. I don't understand the pushback, because I would say the other side of the coin is anyone who wants this week will tell you 69 is not the right number. And that's what we had this week. And there was a cut and it didn't feel right. And it just feels empty. My argument to this is, and I've seen it, and I go back to Doral, that this was before your time.
I mean, this is essentially just a WGC event.
This is what Doral went through. There was the Ford Championship. And one year you had Tiger and Phil going head to head. They very, very rarely did that during the peak of their careers on Sunday. And it was just a madhouse. And Eddie Carboni was the tournament director. And he turned it into something really, really special. It had local flair. It was an event. And it was a full field event. And then it became a WGC. And it was a limited field, I think 70 players. And Championship Management, which is the tour side of the business that runs the WGCs, they came in and made it sterile and made it not as good. And you feel it in the gallery. You feel it walking around the grounds. And I think that has a lot to do with, first, foremost, the fact that there's only 69 players here. Like, I think that has something to do with the vibe of a tournament. I don't know what the right number is. I keep going back to, we can all agree, Augusta National seems to have figured it out. More times than not, they put on a really, really good show, and they're somewhere between 90 and 100 players every year. So I feel like the number's somewhere in there. I just know that 70 doesn't seem like it's it.
70 doesn't feel like it's it. I also had a little bit of an issue with the cut. You know, before, I liked the idea of a cut in these signature events just to have some sort of urgency, something to pay attention to on Friday. But for a time it looked like just three or four players were going to be missing out. It ended up being 11 players who were either not inside the top 50 in ties or not within the 10 shot rule, which the tour has implemented for these kind of legacy events or player hosted invitationals. I think the fix around that, Rex, is to not have a cut, but have a cutoff in terms of who's receiving FedEx Cup points. The cut doesn't necessarily have to be monetary. Keep them around for 4 days. But I think one of the big issues was the fact that if you finished last place in a no-cut event and you were still receiving FedEx Cup points, you're essentially reducing the likelihood that there's going to be that churn. I think they wanted like 35% churn or 65% retention rate for the players who get into signature events. And if you were still handing out FedEx Cup points for finishing 60th, right, in a signature event, that's kind of defeating the purpose. I think that's where you can kind of draw the line. It just seems very weird, maybe even a little bit cruel to get rid of less than a dozen players and make them have the commitment that they have to play in this tournament to kick them out when it's going to be less than a dozen players.
Well, and to go back to your question, I did not understand where Rory was coming from with the cutthroat comments and the smaller fields. And I get it. Like, I have come around from the other side of it. And the tour, this tour, whatever this version of the tour is going to be going forward, it has to be about the stars. It has to be about the product. I just feel like this version of that isn't the best product. And I don't think getting shorter fields, smaller fields, is the answer. So I'm not quite sure where Rory was coming from on that one, because I think we've learned time and time again, East Lake is not a very exciting event more times than not, because you've only got 30 guys there. I'll go back to Doral. You can keep going to where the tour has made smaller and smaller fields, and it doesn't equal to more entertaining or better fields.
Yeah, so I actually like what the PGA Tour has done this year with the full field events and the signature events. I think this swing five and the next 10 that the tour has implemented this year, I actually think it's a pretty good idea, and I actually think it's worked reasonably well. I don't have the data to see exactly how many players have come in and out, but it does at least open the kind of extend the possibility that a Jake Knapp, who won the Mexico Open, followed up with a good week at the Cognizant, could then come here in Bay Hill. He kind of had a forgettable performance here, but let's say he parlays that into something else. And all of a sudden
what he did on six on Saturday was forgettable to you.
the rest of his week outside of the 12 that he made, yes, in the third round on the sixth hole was forgettable. But that sort of story is still allowed to flourish on the PGA Tour, which I think is a good thing. And look, there was a lot of quibbling on social media. I follow a lot of, very inside golfy folks. But I guarantee if you ask kind of a wider swath of golf fan or sports fan, they would probably agree with Rory that it does need to be more cutthroat, that it does need to be just the stars only, that there is probably a little bit too much fluff. There's definitely some fat that can be trimmed, but the inside golf folks don't want to hear that. But I think the larger sports fan in general agrees with the premise that there are way too many guys who have been grifting and freeloading on the PGA Tour for too long.
Absolutely. And that was the one thing that Rory said that I totally agree with. When you look at the priority list, which is how the PGA Tour essentially makes up their fields, and it starts with the major winners and goes all the way down to past champions is the last category. And there's guys hanging on in the past champions category that either haven't played in a decade or shouldn't have played in a decade. And yes, there's plenty of those categories the Tour should and can just start lopping off. I think that was Rory's point, that the Tour is set up to allow these players who are 10 years past their prime just to hold on until they can make it to the Champions Tour. It's time, unfortunately, for those players, for them to sort of just rotate out. I love the idea, if it is Wyndham Clark's idea, but of 100 players, 20 in, 20 out at the end of every year. I think that's the churn that you're looking for. That's exactly what I would like to have. A 20% turnover is pretty good, because that does give your next class, whether that's the next Wyndham Clark or Scottie Scheffler, whatever the case may be, an opportunity to play their way up. And it also gives the guys who aren't there anymore. And someone pointed out that, well, Justin Thomas would have been right on the edge last year of playing his way off the Tour if it was top 100. And my response was, yeah. I mean,
play better.
Play better, man. Like Billy Horschel would have played his way off the Tour. Okay. Sorry.
A more cutthroat product, I think, permeates through the entire PGA Tour ecosystem at every single level. Because the intensity is going to be at the top for those guys trying to get paid, but also at the bottom, Justin Thomas trying to save his season. If you have actually severe and indisputable relegation and promotion, not this thing where, well, you can lose your card, but you can still get in through conditional status and you can still get sponsor exemptions and you're still carving out a 20-event schedule. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an actual class delineation of going from the A Tour to the B Tour, no in-betweens. And so I think that creating a more cutthroat product at the top, I think just makes every other level that much better to try and get inside that top tour eventually. I see where he's coming from. Maybe the execution wasn't great. Maybe it wasn't able to be fleshed out enough on social media. I was a little bit surprised by the backlash. I actually think that is the direction that the PGA Tour needs to go.
Well, Rex, and one of those one of those people that was pushing back, and this was the conversation I had with the tour official, was the Monday Q guy. And Ryan's, you and I both know Ryan. We've worked with Ryan. I think he does a fantastic job. My point to that was, well, because this is impacting exactly what Ryan does. Like, he covers the Korn Ferry Tour. He covers the Monday qualifiers. And so it's going to impact the players he has. So I understand where he's coming from, but I don't disagree with it. I think eventually, if we get to where if this magical international tour that Rory continues to sort of outline for the world, if we ever get there, 190 players, that seems about right. And you do that for 15 or 20 events and you have your turnover and you pick up next season and you do it all over again. It works in other sports. There's no reason it wouldn't work in golf.
Yeah, and look, I love those stories. I love telling those stories. I love writing about those stories. I always have. And there's still an appetite, I believe, among golf fans to have sort of this fresh blood. But I mean, if you still got a 100-person PGA Tour, like, there's plenty of opportunity to have that. Next week's Players Championship is a perfect example. You have a 144-man field, and you have Scottie Scheffler, who I think at this point is a heavy favorite. But there's no reason why Andrew Novak, who has played well over the past month, will not step up and win that golf tournament. It is a tournament that has proven to favor no one, and so that's a prime example. And that is an Andrew Novak victory going to resonate with golf fans? By and large, probably not. And then we're having this exact same discussion where, oh, the Players Championship needs to be 75 guys or 100 players. Like, it's almost too deep. It seems like a no-win proposition, but I do think this is the direction that the PGA Tour is headed. Rex, two quick things before we get out of here. First, no Tiger Woods at the PGA Tour's flagship event. A little bit surprising to me. Tiger, of course, was the one who said that he wanted to do a sort of once a month cadence in terms of his playing schedule. Are you chalking this up to him just looking ahead to the Masters? You think he's eyeing the Valspar? You think he actually suffered some sort of injury setback at the Genesis Invitational? What's your read on it?
I have spoken with one person inside the camp who assured me this is no setback. It's just that his game's not where he wants it right now. And I think we probably saw a version of that in Los Angeles. We probably saw a version of that last year in the Bahamas. He's simply not playing, I'm sure, the way he wants to. And my guess is Tiger Woods is not going to want to go anywhere and play mediocre golf, whether that's TPC Sawgrass or Augusta. So as we get closer to the Masters, I will be curious, because I feel like that would be the play. That would be the tipping point. If he doesn't play there, I think that would be a huge statement.
I thought it was just very interesting as a PGA Tour policy member, as a player who is so instrumental in shaping the future of the PGA Tour, for him to miss it, I think is very notable. I know he has not played it since, I believe, 2019. And yet it still feels like a glaring omission that the PGA Tour's biggest star will not be on the PGA Tour's biggest showcase. I'll be very interested to see, once that 5 o'clock deadline rolls around on Friday, if he gives it another go at Innisbrook, or if it's just full steam ahead till Augusta. And finally,
he's going to play Innisbrook.
I think it's a possibility. I think it's a possibility.
I'll take that bet. No.
I wouldn't totally dismiss it. I don't think it's a realistic possibility.
I'm going to totally dismiss it. So let's take that bet. Let's go ahead and do this right now. Let's put some money on it. He's not going to play. I love Innisbrook. Please, Tracy, I love your event, but he's not playing. Sorry.
Hate to hear that. How about Rex, Anthony Kim? People thought we were haters. And then Anthony Kim, although the finish was not great, he still finished 50th in the 54-person field at LIV Hong Kong. AK did shoot a 65, a 5-under 65 in the final round. One of the best scores of the day. Are you ready to capitulate? Will you be offering a mea culpa?
For what?
On your AK takes.
On my AK takes?
On anyone's AK take, are you ready to jump aboard the bandwagon?
I'm not quite sure why we were characterized as haters. I mean, I was looking forward to watching him come back. Like, I was really looking forward to this. Like, I watched AK in his prime. He was nothing but entertaining. I think the only thing I said that could be construed as hate is, after the fact, I was like, well, what did we expect? He hasn't played in a professional event in 12 years. That's not hating on AK. That's just hating on the reality of the situation. I think the way he finished strong is a very, very good indication that, well, maybe he can. He's got a whole season to figure this out. Like, maybe he can move in a good direction. I think the fact he's going to play in the Asian International Series event next week. I think that's a huge sign. Like, he's clearly motivated to go out and play again. The way he finished the LIV event is very encouraging. I have zero hate for AK.
I thought it was highly encouraged. The number of birdies that he's making should be very encouraging for golf fans. You can always get rid of bogeys. Bogeys are the byproduct of either rust or a little bit of sloppiness, and that's something that can be cleaned up. If this is just his sixth competitive round since returning after a 12-year hiatus. As you mentioned, he's playing an Asian Tour event, and then he's taking a couple weeks off before LIV comes stateside and the Doral event just outside Miami. I love the fact that he's still aggressive. He still putts aggressively. He led the LIV field in putting. I think the early returns are actually a little bit encouraging. I think the 65 was a huge swing for AK, still showing that it's in there. You know, it may take weeks, it may take months to do this on any sort of consistent level, and I still have a hard time imagining him once again as a top 50 player in the world. But the fact that he was able to shoot 65 and make the number of birdies that he did throughout these 54 holes, I thought was very encouraging. You're coming up to my neck of the woods, Rex, in just a matter of hours. We'll be doing the full Players Preview podcast on Wednesday. But what are you most looking forward to Players Championship weeks, which begins in about 12 hours?
Barbecue at your house tomorrow night? Isn't that what I'm most looking forward to? Isn't that the right answer?
It was supposed to be, and then I'm getting pressed to duty. You're doing your bad 90 seconds of television as well. We're going to have to look forward to something else.
All right. If I had to look forward to something else, it's definitely Jay Monahan. He's scheduled right now to talk to the media on Tuesday. I do think it's interesting. They carved out an entire hour. It's 11 to noon that he's going to talk to us. If you look at the schedule, there are no players.
What do you want to ask him? What's the one question you want to ask him?
Well, I have a number of questions. Probably the one off the top of my head was exactly what PGA Enterprises is going to be. Because I think we talk about it a lot and we throw it out there like, oh, it's just obvious. This is what it's going to be. Like, I really need him to go on the record and differentiate between what the PGA Tour is going to be and what PGA Tour Enterprises is going to be. Because I don't think anybody truly understands what the two bodies are going to be. I know the one's going to be for profit. I understand that. But also keep in mind that the tour is a collection of tournaments that aren't necessarily owned by the PGA Tour. The Phoenix event, for example, is run by the Thunderbirds, which is a charitable organization out there. So I think there's just a lot of sort of logistical questions that I would like to have.
I'll probably workshop this phrasing a little bit, but where's the urgency is certainly one of them. We seem to want one thing. The players certainly want one thing. The golf fans certainly want one thing, and that's all of it to come back together again. And yet the PGA Tour players on the policy board have not yet talked to LIV or any representatives from the PIF about what they actually want. How can that possibly be? How can we be almost 12 months since the anniversary of June 6th with this deal being consummated? How has there not been more meaningful progress on that front? Is a question I think that needs to be answered.
I don't think the policy, the player directors talking to someone from PIF is important. I mean, these are negotiations going on. I mean, eventually the conversations are going to have, but trust me when I tell you, Webb Simpson's not sitting at the table and going over a spreadsheet and deciding exactly what the numbers are. That's not what they're doing. I mean, I think you're being foolish if you think at some point, yeah, there does need to be a face-to-face, but I'm less concerned about that. I actually want to take it back. I want to change my question to Jay Monahan because this is based on
You only get the microphone once.
I know. Now I had to workshop it myself. I have 2 hours in the car tomorrow morning to figure it out. And Webb Simpson was asked this by myself just the other day. Is there a danger of the PGA Tour not striking a deal with the PIF? And his answer was yes, absolutely. And and he went on to explain why he believes that. I would like to ask Jay the same thing because it seems to me we're at a inflection point where the tour is feeling themselves a little bit because they got $1.5 billion investment from SSG and another $1.5 billion is out there if they need it or if they want it. And maybe they're starting to feel like maybe we can carry on the way we're doing right now and let them carry on the way they're doing right now. I don't think that's realistic. I think a fractured game is only going to make things worse.
TV ratings suggest otherwise. TV ratings suggest that this is no longer a highly successful product.
And I do think I need to clean something up on Friday. We talked about something on the podcast on Wednesday about a possible conference call on Friday. Yes. There was no such conference call as I think I predicted. It was wild speculation. I was simply trying to make a point. There was no such conference call.
Thank you for buttoning that up.
I had to clean that up.
Journalist that you are. Rex, before we get out of here, what do you have on the website? What sort of slop are you putting together that the folks at home can go check out?
I don't feel like you're selling this very well. I kind of took a deep dive into the last 12 months for Scotty and what it must have been like. Sort of, I mean, here's a guy that cares deeply, as you pointed out, as you know better than most people, the fact that he does want to be a perfectionist. Like the way he hits the golf ball, that is more times than not perfection. And not many people in the world in the history of the game have been able to say that. And for him to struggle with what he struggled with on the greens, I think it's hard for me to wrap my mind around, but it must have been so difficult. It must have been so taxing for him. And I am taken by the idea that he finally just let it go. Like, look, man, I'm going to try the best I possibly can, but I cannot let this consume me. And that's the thing that produced what I would argue was a perfect round on Sunday.
My story had to die so yours could live. Folks, the least you could do is go check it out on NBCSports.com. /golf. Instead, I'll be dumping my 1,500 words on Scottie Scheffler and his winless drought in my Microsoft Outlook trash.
That was it? 1,500? That's nothing for you. You don't clear your throat 1,500. Wow.
I know. That's why this was not an obit. It was merely Scottie Scheffler's reflections. Instead, it will never see the light of day. I'm sure we will be discussing it on the evening live from on Monday night. And I'm sure you and I, when we do our little song and dance on live from throughout the rest of Players Championship Week, We'll be diving into all things Scottie Scheffler. You have to think he's a heavy favorite at this point to take
many pots. Balls. Many pots.
If major, that is a great plug, Rex. We'll not just be doing the preview podcast on Wednesday afternoon live from TPC Sawgrass, but we'll also be doing mini pods each and every tournament round. We promise we'll keep it 15, 20 minutes, maybe 25, maybe 30, depending how heated things go and how compelling the leaderboard is. But as always, we appreciate the support, all the feedback, and you guys listening in each and every week. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. You guys know the drill, nbcsports.com/golf for all the rest of your golf needs. We'll talk to you guys in a couple days when the Players Championship gets underway.